and nobody could show anything in court. So it was done with a secret court under secret interpretations of laws and so on. I mean, this was all a secret government.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV. Today we're talking with William Binney. He was a longtime NSA employee who quit the service, the National Security Agency, shortly after the 9/11 attacks when he was acting as technical leader for intelligence. He's kind of like Edward Snowden 1.0. He helped to unmask a lot of NSA abuses. And we're going to talk with him about what he found, what he thinks about recent revelations, and why the earlier range of concerns really didn't set the world on fire the same way that more recent ones have. William Binney, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
In 2002, you, Kirk Wiebe, and Edward Loomis asked the Department of Defense to investigate the NSA, an agency you had been working at for 30 years plus, for wasting money on Trailblazer. What was Trailblazer? What did it do, and why did you object to that?
Trailblazer was the NSA's attempt to catch up with the digital age. That is, communications were exploding, and they felt they were falling behind, so they tried to create a program that was to try to bring them into that digital age so they can manage the communications and sorting out what was important for them to look at. The problem is Trailblazer didn't do anything. As far as I know, it didn't produce anything for roughly a little over $4 billion.
And this was an attempt to vacuum up all forms of digital communications and transactions and things like that?
Originally, I don't know if they had that as their objective, but certainly they had the objective was to be able to deal with it. So if they didn't vacuum it up, they had to at least look through it.
Right.
So. And
you say it was a waste of money, partly because it was ineffective.
Yeah, it never produced anything. Yeah, that's right.
Is that a general problem with these kinds of overarching technological solutions to information gathering, that when you start bringing in everything, you can't... people always talk about it's like finding a needle in a haystack, and a lot of people seem to want to have more and more hay rather than more and more needles.
Yes, that's part of the problem. The other part is they brought in contractors from the outside, engineers and computer scientists and things like that, to solve what is fundamentally an analytic problem. So they didn't have the expertise to solve it. And yet the NSA was outsourcing the job to do that to contractors who didn't have the background to make
that happen. What do you mean by that? How is an analytic issue separate from, collection of data?
Well, for example, the public switch telephone network. If you want to address that, how do you pick out the public switch telephone network? All the things that are important for you to look at as an analyst to report on. Mm-hmm. That is, if there are just terrorists calling into somebody in California and somebody in California calling Yemen or something like that, then how do you figure out what's important in that data to pull out so that your analyst can look at? Well, you have to know the public switch telephone network is organized, the numbering scheme for the worldwide plan, and know how to look at blocks of allocations of numbers and which ones work with other numbers, and basically building social networks. That's an analytic issue to target. And then you say, these are the groups of targets I want from that data. So then that becomes your priority list of targets. And you list them for them to sort out as you
and
see them.
And we'll come back to this, but so that's the beginning. It's analytics is what tells you what information you should be looking for.
It makes it possible for you to smartly do it, yeah.
Okay, and you had proposed, or you were a champion of a program called ThinTread,
yes,
as opposed to Trailblazer, and I assume that was something that would allow you to focus on information you thought was obviously important.
Yes. In fact, we had that one running on three different sites, full time, 24 hours a day, for in late November 2000. We had all the system running all the way back to the analysts and into the databases. So we had the entire problem solved.
Why would the NSA say, that's nice, but we don't want that. We're going to go with a big program that costs more money but doesn't get any results.
Well, because it helps build their empire,
right.
Okay? Adds more people to the government roles, adds more contractors, more contracts, more money.
Right.
So the budget goes up. So you get a bigger budget, you get a bigger organization. That's what it
does. Now, you were extremely frustrated that the NSA or that the American intelligence community did not manage to provide the type of intelligence that would have prevented 9/11. Did that play into your decision to leave?
Fundamentally, yeah. It's all really wrapped together because when you have an agenda that focuses more in a corrupt way, building contracts and so on, instead of focusing on solving the mission, which is intelligence, and then predicting intentions and capabilities of potential enemies, terrorists and so on, so that you can stop it. When you focus on money acquisition as the main issue as opposed to intelligence production, you're defeating the entire purpose of the agencies.
And you have talked about, do you have evidence or was this work that you were doing before 9/11 or before the war on terror was kind of officially inaugurated, that the NSA and other intelligence agencies were actually doing kind of mass gathering of data and surveillance on Americans?
No, in fact, that was one of their major problems. They couldn't collect enough. That was they only were doing minuscule amounts.
Mm-hmm. On America or people in America?
Well, on the on the internet. Mm-hmm. Or the phone networks were much more easy to manage because they had the telecommunications company helping them.
Right.
But the internet was a total different story. So they had to build that one. That's what Trailblazer was all about, to try
to catch up with that.
And to catch up with the rates. And they called it the volume, velocity, variety problem. Mm-hmm. Like in the internet, you get voice over IP, video, all kinds of communications, file transfers, chatter, email, all kinds of things. So that was the variety. Mm-hmm. Velocity is going to speed of light, and right. Volume means there's a lot of it.
Right.
So, but with Thin Thread, we looked at that as those are all positive things. Volume means you get more data to look through to find your targets. You get more data on your targets. Velocity, of course, means you get it faster, and variety means you get more aspects. All of that's positive. So that's what we leveraged, and that's what we had working before 9/11.
Right. Do you think that the U.S. should have been able to stop 9/11, or at least uncover the plot?
Absolutely, yeah.
And so was the primary failure, because you hear about this, and when we looked at the actual kind of coordination of agencies, between various FBI bureaus and whatnot, it seemed like, it was tantalizingly, tragically close to having the plot, or at least some of the conspirators, stop beforehand. Is it a human failing? Is it a technological failing? Is it a political failing? What allowed 9/11 to happen?
Well, I think it was probably a mixture of all of that.
Yeah.
Humans, because they, first of all, a lot of the material they didn't recognize or they didn't see in the database because they had a lot of data at the time. They thought they had a lot of data, but it really was only probably 0.1% of what was really out there. Mm-hmm. So they, even with that minuscule amount, relatively, they still couldn't find information.
Right.
So it was still sitting there, so the humans couldn't get it. And the technology issue was one of automation. That is, we had to build in automated processes that would go through that data to pull out what was important, that what we knew about and things that were related, so that then we could push that to the top of the queue of analysts to look at.
Talk a little bit about, so let's say you're sifting through networks that include telephone calls, numbers going in, because we're talking here not about actually listening to the calls, but about the metadata, right? About who called whom, when.
That's how you would select the information out to record.
Yeah. Right. And then there's also internet traffic. Walk through, how do you possibly figure out, how do you blend those together so that, people who are terrorists, you know where to look for them?
First of all, in the telephone network, the entire scheme for the world is uniquely numbered.
Right.
That is, zone one of the world is the U.S., Canada, and some of the islands. Zone two is Africa. Zone three and four are in South and North Europe. Five is South America. Six is Australia and Southeast Asia. Seven is Russia. Eight is the rest of Asia, China and Japan and so on. And nine is the Middle East and South Asia.
Right.
Those are the numbers, like in your phone book, when you dial long distance, mm-hmm. you hit one. That means you're in zone one.
Right.
If you go international, you have to dial 01 or 011 here in the United States for operator assisted or station to station. Then the next number you have to dial is the switch for the zone of the world.
So everything is tracked, and there's similar IP addresses on the internet also.
And all of these things have to connect. After all, they're machines routing this, so they you have to tell them exactly what to do to get the ends connected in the world. So that's how you make the judgment of who's communicating with who. Mm-hmm.
But then does it start with knowing that, okay, in, you know, in Munich, there's a guy, you know, that actual field agents know is in Munich and has terrorist ties.
That's like a seed.
Yeah.
And that seed, then you'd build, look at all his phone calls, who he communicates with that number, or his email address, IP, or username, user service provider, a combination, that kind of
right.
thing, or machine access code number. So there's a whole lot of yeah. ways you could do that, but that gives you the way of pulling back together all the information that involves his communications, either in phone or email, or anything else, really. If he wants to visit something, you'd still track it by that IP or
right.
things like that. So that then allows you to collapse all of the social network of that particular person back together so you know their entire environment just from the metadata.
Right.
So that's why metadata is more important than content, really, because it gives you the scope of
right.
what they're up to. And also it allows you to order it in terms of a timeline so you can see how they're interacting over time.
Right.
Whereas content won't necessarily do that yeah. for you.
And so I assume then that if you see suddenly somebody's placing a lot of calls or a lot of long calls or intermittent calls or emails or whatever someplace, you assume that something is up.
That's the first key, yeah.
yeah.
And then you focus in on it and see,
right.
try to figure it out,
right.
yeah.
Okay, in 2005, you helped the New York Times, or you were involved in a New York Times investigation, an expose of the NSA warrantless wiretapping program that caused quite a scandal in the Bush administration. In 2007, you were investigated by the FBI about, you know, possibly leaking national security statements. You were cleared of all charges, but you were also raided by the FBI. What
right.
what were they looking for? And, you know, did you actually leak state secrets? Now that you're cleared, right, you can tell us the truth.
No, in fact, they knew I didn't, okay,
right.
because they had Stellar Wind. They had all my phone calls and emails.
Stellar Wind.
Explain. Stellar Wind was the basic reason I left NSA in 2001, because that's when they started to take the program that I did to do social network reconstruction
right.
of everybody in the world, and direct that basically against everybody in the United States. That meant they were basically putting a pen register on every phone number in the United States. Pen register is like they call it a trace and tap,
mm-hmm.
where I put this device on your line and I can monitor
right.
who you call, how long you call them, and...
And the NSA historically or statutorily is not supposed to be looking at things within the United States except under very rare or very
except
specific
warrant,
circumstances.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a warrant built on probable cause.
Right.
So
and we'll get to that because
right.
that's really at the root of all this. So Stellar Wind allowed the NSA, or rather under Stellar Wind, the NSA started looking in the U.S. when it's
right.
supposed to mostly be looking out. And what did what were you suspected of having done?
Well, that was a pretext, okay? The whole idea was to retribution for our DODIG complaint against NSA for corruption, fraud, waste, and abuse.
Right.
That was the reason they raided us. Everybody who signed that complaint was raided that day. That was Ed Loomis, Kirk Wiebe, myself, and also Diane Rourke, who was the senior staffer on the House Intelligence Committee. So we had both the Congress and people from inside NSA complaining about the corruption there. So we were all raided at the same time because of that. And they used the pretext of the New York Times leak of the mm-hmm. warrantless wiretapping.
Right. So they were claiming that you were one
right.
of the leakers.
But they already knew from Stellar Wind that we
right.
had no contact with those people.
Right. So what happens when the FBI raid your house or raid your belongings?
For me, they came in with guns drawn and they came up, pointed guns at my family and me. So I was getting out of the shower.
Yeah.
You know, I just asked them if I could put some clothes on, you know.
Right.
I wasn't really... I mean, I was in the military. I had people pointing guns at me at different times. So, but they came in and they just got us isolated. My family was there. I was on the back porch, and they went through and searched everything and took my computer. And
right. And at that point, you were running a consulting business.
We had a consulting business. Yeah.
That can't be good for business, is it?
No, in fact, it destroyed our business.
Yeah.
yeah.
Did you get your materials back?
Not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
See. They claimed that under NSA A-59, NSA Act 1959, that if there was something sensitive, nothing was classified, okay?
Right.
But they said if there was something that was sensitive to them, they could keep it and not tell us what it was or return it.
Yeah.
So in other words, they claimed that some of the stuff was a pretext to justify the raid, okay?
Right.
That's all. So and
that's mostly just to you think it was like to send a scare into you or to
it was to intimidate us to keep quiet.
You know, now you're a patriotic fellow. You volunteered for the military during Vietnam. You spent your entire career at the NSA. Does you know, does this type of activity make you think twice about you know, the goodness of the American experiment?
That's the reason I've been coming out publicly, is because the where I see it going is toward a totalitarian state. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got the NSA doing all this collection of material on all of its citizens. That's what the SS, the Gestapo, the Stasi, the KGB, and the MVD did. I mean, these are the people I worked for 30 years.
Right, okay? And you were a Russia specialist, right?
Yeah,
you covered or you surveilled the Russian military.
Russian and
the
Warsaw Pact, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so you know how totalitarians did things, right?
Yeah, well, that's why Chancellor Merkel was calling what they're doing here, the actions like the Stasi. Yeah.
Do you think that's a legitimate analogy?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Now, why is it though? Because I mean, or play that out a little bit more. Have we seen, you know, one of the things that was a kind of common feature in East Germany or in the Soviet Union was that, you know, you'd look out the window and you'd see your neighbor being hustled out and then nobody ever talked about him again. Is that really happening in the U.S. or is it likely to?
Well, they're using that data that NSA is collecting to arrest people right now through the Drug Enforcement Agency and the FBI.
Right.
They're already doing that. And it's not a warrant, so they have to do a parallel construction to go out and find other material that would substitute for that.
Right. You're saying then that, you know, say the DEA uses data that they gather from an intelligence agency.
From NSA.
Okay. And then they go out and they find the actual, you know, they can't say, oh, well, we got this tip from NSA, so we're arresting you. But they know this person is doing this, that, and the other thing.
Right.
So then they go out and track them.
That's right. Well, actually, they go out and arrest them. They say, some of them have said, at least in the article in Reuters, they said we were told simply to go to this parking lot, wait for this truck to come in. When it comes in and parks over there, go arrest them. Mm-hmm. Bring the drug dogs in and go get find the drugs. Mm-hmm. So, but that's all content. That's what NSA is collecting, and that's what the FBI and the DEA and the other law enforcement agencies mm-hmm. are using.
And we'll talk more about this, but you know, isn't that what intelligence is for? Because as long as they're going after guilty people, what's wrong with that? You and I, or at least me, I have nothing to worry about because I'm not a criminal. What's wrong with that kind of logic?
Well, I don't have any problem with as long as they do it constitutionally, mm-hmm. and it follows the Constitution of the United States, which is violating. I mean, this is a direct violation of privacy of everybody in the country. I mean, after all, there's so many laws in this country that you can find some law you're breaking.
Right.
So if they want to come after you, then they've got a pretext now because they've got everything you've ever done recorded.
And I mean, let's be, you know, and this might just be the cold warrior, you know, America's number one and me fanboy going, but we're doing it better than the Soviet Union or the Stasi ever did, right?
We're doing better in terms of collecting amounts of data so that you can individually target people if you want to.
Right.
We're not doing very good at stopping terrorist attacks, for example.
Yeah. Okay, well, how is that then? I mean, if the government is capable of surveilling basically everything everybody is doing, how does that not lead to stopping every possible terrorist act?
Because fundamentally they have to do it manually. That's what the White House Big Data Initiative was about a year and a half ago. That initiative was soliciting private industry to come up with algorithms to go through big data sets. Mm-hmm. And find important material in there and tell them what is important in that data, because they're otherwise they're reduced. They're like right now they have to do it manually to a certain degree,
right.
Which means they're limited in the capacity. So if you draw the analogy on this needle in the haystack, if you're looking for that needle, it doesn't help at all to make the haystack orders of magnitude bigger.
Right.
It only makes the problem orders of magnitude harder to find it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're fundamentally failing. They're causing themselves to become dysfunctional.
But you also argue essentially that's kind of the point, that they want to have a bigger and bigger haystack because that's where their empire, that's where their power is.
Right.
Not really in actually finding the needles.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's the real problem. That's why I had to leave there, because it was all built on corruption.
Well, you know, so now you are a whistleblower. You went through, you and your colleagues went through official channels.
Yep.
Was that a wise decision?
Well, you know, since I always viewed the United States as we, the guys who had the white hats,
right.
You know,
yeah.
I thought, gee, well, you know, if the people downtown and in different congressional committees knew about this, they would start to fulfill their oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution and would do the right thing. And if not there, then perhaps through the IGs,
right.
And so on, or through the courts, we could get that done. So we kept trying for the better part of 7 years to make that known, to try to get the government to start to address some of its criminal activity.
Right.
But instead, they went the other way, and they, to the dark side, basically, doing mm-hmm. retroactive immunity for the crimes, for the telecoms, the crimes that they
right.
were committing, basically keeping everything else secret so nobody could show anything in court. So it was done with a secret court, under secret interpretations of laws and so on. I mean, this is all a secret government.
Talk a little bit about the telecommunications companies, which were handing over data to the government, and then they were given immunity because most of them had terms of service where they weren't supposed to be doing that. Do they really have a choice in any of that? I mean, if the government says, I mean, what are the options?
Well, the options were to say, give me a written warrant,
mm-hmm.
then I'll fulfill the warrant.
Right.
That's what the CEO of Quest did.
Right.
Of course, now he's in jail. I mean,
that's
they target
right.
him. So, you see, if you don't do what the government yeah. wants, they can target you. So,
well, let's talk about Edward Snowden because he, you know, and there's a host of questions because he is clearly building on, on the actions, or he learned from your experience and
yeah.
people like you experience. Was he wise not to go through official channels?
We were a clear demonstration that official channels didn't work. I mean, they just simply don't work.
Right.
I mean, if you do like we did or like Tom Drake did, you know, they attempted to indict us three separate times during the period 2007 to 2009. So, but they failed because we had exculpatory data and we actually were threatening them with malicious prosecution if they tried that. So they dropped everything on us. But they didn't. They still had Tom Drake.
Mm-hmm.
And they
and explain who he is and how he fits
into this. He was still a senior executive at NSA and was still working for the agency at the time in 2007. He was raided 4 months after we were, so he was a supporter of the Thin Thread program too, and also, but he talked to Siobhan Gorman in the Baltimore Sun about some of the corruption and waste and fraud.
And that was considered leaking of sensitive material.
That's what NSA considered it.
Right.
However,
yes.
if you take the strict reading of Executive Order 13526, Section 1.7, which is the executive order covering classification for the U.S. government, mm-hmm. You cannot cover up a crime,
mm-hmm.
fraud, waste, or abuse by classification.
So,
it's not really.
Right,
I mean.
Right. And that's on a certain level, you're hoping that's what you get to defend in court.
That would be argued in a court, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So, Edward Snowden, you've been critical in some of your discussions of what he's doing. You think that he has absolutely provided a public service in bringing to light in a way that is unescapable, particularly the Verizon warrant, or rather the order for Verizon that's come to light in over the past year. You are critical that when he starts talking about how the U.S. is surveilling other foreign countries, that, you know, that might not actually be very useful. Is that right?
Yes. For example, the back doors and things like that in different systems. The fact that it's happening, I mean, I think every country in the world tries to do this. Okay. And they try to market products with their companies around the world with these back doors in them. So I mean, it's not...
And by back door, I mean, essentially, that's a way where a particular country intelligence service can basically skip into whatever somebody's doing using a particular piece of hardware or software.
Right, because of implanted software
right.
that would allow them to manipulate
those devices. And everybody's doing that. And so and essentially, I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is that you are not anti-NSA. You are anti the way NSA or the way that surveillance
right.
and intelligence is being gathered now.
Yes,
yeah.
Because they went they moved away from targeting the groups that were doing bad things, or militaries, or governments, things
right.
like that, into collecting information on every individual in the world.
Right.
I mean, when you do that, not only do you make yourself dysfunctional because of the volume of information,
right.
but you're also creating this totalitarian process in spreading it around
mm-hmm.
the world, which is infecting all the democracies.
Here, let me—I mean, you started at the NSA in 1970
as a civilian.
Yes.
Okay. Right.
So, you know, throughout over the course of the 70s and during the Church Commission hearings and various other hearings about things, we learned that the NSA had actually illegally been opening all sorts of mails, telegrams, communications, listening in, you know, on hundreds of thousands, if not millions of communications. Why would you be surprised that they are, you know, suddenly the NSA, once it can gather data on everybody, that it would start to do that? I mean, it seems kind of naive on your part, isn't it?
Well, no, actually, if you stick with the charter of NSA, it's to do foreign intelligence. That's not foreign, that's domestic.
Right.
So right up front, that doesn't meet the charter.
Yeah.
Secondly, it's pointless to do that because those aren't the real, those aren't real threats.
Right.
I mean, the real threats are, were at the time from the, in the Cold War, it was the Soviet Union, the main one, and
right.
China, and so on. Those were the opposing militaries and major threats in the world.
Right. Here, well, you know, one of the things that, I mean, and it's interesting when you first talked about Trailblazer, the, you know, you brought it up in the context of this is a waste of money and resources that doesn't produce anything worth doing. I mean, it's kind of like you were trying to be a good government employee by uncovering waste.
Yeah.
Here's a question. I mean, is the NSA so inept? And, you know, we hear this about things like the FBI spent years and billions of dollars trying to update its computer system. It was a complete failure. The CIA did not understand that the Soviet Union was about to collapse or the Berlin Wall was about to come down. I mean, there's these high-level instances of incompetence. And then when you get to someone like Edward Snowden, if the NSA is any good at what it's doing, how did it allow him to get in and get out with what, you know, some NSA officials are saying, like, he took everything? I mean, is the NSA a fundamentally incompetent agency?
Well, let me put it this way. In the Thin Thread program back in the late 90s, mm-hmm. we were preparing and proposing to do an automated analysis of the network log.
Mm-hmm.
that meant if you set up a network, a communications network inside mm-hmm. with a bunch of computers on it
right.
and servers, then when anybody sends a line of instruction down that network, it always gets logged. Like if you hit mm-hmm. a carriage, if you hit your mouse, that click will send an instruction mm-hmm. down the line, or if you type something into your computer and hit return, that sends an instruction down the line.
Right.
All that could be mapped back to your position because it carries mm-hmm. your MAC number and IP
right.
and so on. So,
right.
so you can be mapped, and the network log has it all laid out of everything you're doing on the mm-hmm. network when you're on it. So if you imagine thousands of people on the network simultaneously, well, we were preparing to do a network log analysis to we could follow what everybody was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the primary reasons we would do that would be to watch what analysts do with the data
right.
so that we can see whether or not they're using good analytic techniques or not, if they needed training or something mm-hmm. like that. We would also use it as a training tool. but also, if anybody started to download something,
mm-hmm.
you would know it immediately.
Right.
So we ran into two main camps of opposition in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, and this is a good one, the analysts objected to being monitored, their actions being mm-hmm. monitored.
Right.
Which is a joke, right?
Yeah.
considering what they're doing.
Right, right.
And secondly, management opposed it because if we did that, you see, we would know every transaction going on with money transfers, all the spending on a given program, all the program returns in terms of the results coming back from field sites and inputs from any source.
Right.
We could monitor all that, and then we could list it out in terms of auditability. What is the return right. on investment in this program or that one? And management didn't want that at all because that could make them accountable for how they spent money in this success or failure of a program.
So in another way, I mean, basically what you're saying is that at the most technologically sophisticated and powerful reaches of government, you're seeing exactly the same dynamics that you would find at the lowest level kind of division of motor vehicle bureau, where people are like, hey, I'm getting my job done. You don't have to look at me. You don't have to follow me. You know, just trust me.
Right.
Wow.
Right. But that leads to corruption, too, because they're not
yeah.
audited.
Right.
The government doesn't audit NSA.
Right.
Or CIA or any of the other intelligence agencies.
Yeah. Well, they can't, though, right? Because it's all sensitive material.
If they
audit it, they'd have to kill the auditors, right?
No, nothing stopping them having yeah. cleared analysts come in and doing an audit.
Do you have a sense of, you know, people always talk about the NSA as like the ultimate kind of black box within the government. What, you know, what is the NSA budget?
I think it's probably on the order of it's over $10 billion a year now, I think, and probably you have to add another $8 to $10 billion, probably, or maybe $6 to $8 billion for the services, the NSA, CSS, combined security services.
And how much of that do you think is money well spent?
I would probably think no more than 50% of it.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about a couple people who are in the news recently. You know, we know that James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, is a liar. I mean, by his own admission, he acknowledged that, you know, he was trying to say the least untruthful things to a senator.
Not wittingly.
Yeah. But what about Keith Alexander? You have harsh words for him. And talk a little bit about him and the kind of the hierarchy at the NSA.
Well, he's kind of sitting, he's putting forth an argument, a false argument. For example, saying that, well, when before 9/11, when the two terrorists came into the West Coast and called home to or back to the Yemen center, and that we could tell the Yemen center, but we couldn't tell the other end.
Right.
He must have.
And he's saying that.
But he's saying that in the sense of, well, if it's in the United States, we couldn't tell that end in the United States, and so my daughter, for example, uses the phone in the United States, and so therefore. Any of the terrorists can also use it, so we need to take it all in to find it. Well, that's predicated on the assumption that you can't tell what the end is in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's simply false. I mean,
now, was he saying he couldn't tell the end because the NSA was blocked from tracing the call back?
No, he just was saying it outright that we couldn't tell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was simply false. I mean, we could tell exactly who it was. That was all in the collection database.
Mm-hmm.
The problem.
Why would he dissemble on that, especially if it's something that is so easily shown to be
right? It's like having caller ID on.
Right.
That's all. Well, I mean, that's the narrative coming out because that supports the argument for collecting everything in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't tell where it is, you have to collect it all and then sort it out later.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying that you can't identify it really in real time. That's simply false. I mean, we had no difficulty identifying. Anywhere in the world, who these numbers were, where they were going to, or whether they were mobile or fixed.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have any problem doing that it was collected.
He is, you would say that he is saying that knowing that he is wrong.
Yes.
I mean, okay.
So he's setting an argument. He's trying to set up a false syllogism to argue to continue doing what they are doing.
Right. Is there a way for the NSA to actually collect data within the United States, or which would not just be blanket, a free blank check to do whatever they wanted?
Yes, I mean we had proposed that, and we left those principles with them when we left.
Right.
But the whole idea was.
I got a feeling they didn't look at those very whatever documents you left. Probably
what they did was
that
is once we had a U.S. person contacting a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
We would do things like encrypt all the attributes so you couldn't tell who it was, and that would be in the collection database as well. So you never really had the truth. It was always under an encryption.
Mm-hmm.
And it would stay that way until you build probable cause. If you could build probable cause, show it to a court, then you could decrypt them and target them that way.
Mm-hmm.
And also pass it on to the FBI to target.
What else is Alexander, what do you think are his other falsehoods that he's peddling in order to either maintain the status quo or expand it even more?
But he also said things like we didn't have the capability to connect the dots before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
That was false.
Yeah.
I mean, that program with connecting the dots was there, running, and well. And they took that program and used it to do all the spying on U.S. citizens and everybody else in the world. That's all the same software.
Was that a larger argument within the kind of intelligence community generally? Because, I mean, a lot of the things that ended up being written into the Patriot Act had been asked for by the CIA, by the FBI, by other agencies before 9/11, one of which was we couldn't communicate among agencies and that's why this all fell through the cracks. You're saying that that's really not quite accurate?
No.
Yeah.
Plus, in fact, they didn't write all that capability into the Patriot Act. They had to have a secret interpretation of Section 215 of the business records part. Mm-hmm. That secret interpretation let them do that. Not the law. I mean, Representative Sensenbrenner, who wrote that thing, said, we were never intended you to be able to do this.
Right.
And in fact, if you take the words literally, it doesn't say that. It says,
and it doesn't say what?
It says in Section 215 that you're authorized to go for any data relevant to a terrorist investigation.
Right.
It doesn't say you have the relative to a terrorist. And it doesn't say potentially relative.
Right.
That's the way their secret interpretation goes. That means that everything's potentially
and
relevant.
That means, I mean, this is at the source of the ability of the government in, through various agencies to simply assert that there is a relevance, and hence we have an absolute blanket right to do whatever we want.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it applies to everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they did this bulk collection of information.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are two kind of extraordinary developments just in the very recent moments. One is Judge Richard Leon in the Clayman case against the NSA, denouncing the NSA's actions as almost Orwellian. And then a presidential commission just recently this week issued a report concluding that the NSA can safeguard American lives and American interests without violating the Fourth Amendment guarantees. You know, they talk about reforming the FISA courts. That metadata should stay in private hands rather than immediately be done in public. The end to using national security letters, which are essentially a writ of assistance or a suspicionless warrant, and that there should be a civilian to head the NSA rather than a general, which the President Obama has already said he's not interested in hearing that. You know, well, are these things going to work? I mean, what are the ways then to kind of constrain the absolute power that the NSA clearly wields in a technological realm?
Well, you see, in my view, all that stuff that they're talking about is like putting lipstick on a pig.
Okay.
That's basically what it is. It does absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the courts, no matter what they do, the courts and the intelligence committees or the rest of Congress, they have no way of really verifying anything that NSA or the FBI are telling them. And for example, the FISA court is known, I mean, it was published in by the New York Times as early as August 2002 that they were misleading that court to get warrants. They knew that from the beginning. This is a long-standing problem.
Okay, so let's say, I mean, and you've been critical of, you know, part of it is people like Keith Alexander are, and James Clapper are lying to Congress. They're saying, oh, well, we're not doing that or we're doing this, or we can't tell you. Because, you know, then we would, you know, it would compromise national security. You have to trust us.
That's nonsense,
okay,
too.
Right. If the recommendations that are, you know, being put forth by a presidential commission are no good, what are the ways where you can actually, you know, rein in the power of the NSA so that it is both protecting American lives and interests and staying within the constraints of the Fourth Amendment or the Constitution?
We had proposed to Congress earlier this year, it's a couple months ago, that is the whistleblowers that were involved in this thin thread program. Here's how you can verify what NSA is telling you.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically revolved around the Congress and the courts having organic technical capabilities with them and subordinate to them, so they're directly responsible to them, not to any intelligence agency. So that these technical groups would then be cleared and have positions inside NSA or any FBI or any of the other agencies where they could go in, go across any network, look at any of the data that's in there, monitor what's available in those databases.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you could go into NSA when Senator Wyden asked for how many US citizens are in your databases, right? The official answer that came back says, well, we can't tell you because that would be a violation of their privacy rights.
Right.
I mean, that's ridiculous. Well, it would take a simple little set of program to go through. I'm going to count every phone number in there that starts with a one.
Mm-hmm.
And then just look in the front of your white pages. You list the area codes down, which part of the U.S., which are part of Canada, and so on. I'll just count the ones that are in the U.S. That's a simple program that would tell.
Who would man that? I mean, who would man those? Those task force that are able to go through.
I think that the it should be drawn from a set of hackers inside the United States,
mm-hmm.
and that these hackers should be rotated periodically so that they're not there, and they don't get infected by the existing structure like Congress is,
right?
Or even the agencies, so that you would always have a fresh set of hackers in there.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to find out what they're doing wrong.
Wouldn't you also be, just creating the next generation of supervillains who, you know, go in, they have a great understanding of what's going on, and then they get rotated out and they start their life of crime or terrorism?
Well, you have to go through a clearance process, including for NSA, you have to have a polygraph and things like that every 5 years, at least that's when I was in, they were doing that. So, I mean, you have to go through a clearance process to be able to access that data.
Now, I mean, you is Congress capable? I mean, you know, Congress, and, you know, we should talk a little bit about your relationship to, or your Republican Party affiliation, and your kind of long, interesting history with Richard Nixon in terms of, you know, kind of the way that you think about things. But is, you know, Congress, at least for the past 40 years, has been giving away its power. It's been ceding its power when it comes to, you know, making war or declaring war. It seems to kind of give away its power to, you know, to various agencies to say, okay, yeah, we'll believe you.
Yeah.
I mean, what is wrong with Congress? And is Congress really capable of exercising any kind of backbone to make sure that the government surveillance apparatus is not just running amok with all of our rights?
Well, they certainly don't appear to, do they? Mm-hmm. I mean, some people seem to have a backbone down there, but the rest of them don't. Mm-hmm. And the you know, I guess the forces down there are just too numerous right now to be able to get something moving. That's why we need to fire most of them.
Yeah, are there heroes in Congress or in the government that you can point to?
Well, some of them are even Democrats. I'm a registered Republican for about 50 years, so. But I would say there's even some Democrats down there, like Senators Wyden and Udall.
Right.
Those folks and
Rand Paul.
Rand Paul, right. Some of the other younger Republicans
Amash
are there.
Types.
Yeah, Amash and Conyers is joining him too, so he's one of the old Democrats. So.
Yeah.
I mean, and they were trying to unfund NSA, and they just about did that. And we were trying to support that here because that's one of the ways of stopping them to do this, take away their money, and they can't afford to do it.
Talk a little bit about Richard Nixon and, you know, why Gerald Ford is actually one of your personal villains not politically per se, but in terms of how it affects national intelligence and the way in which the Constitution is overrun.
Well, after the Watergate affair and the Church Committee started investigating, they found out about Program Shamrock, which was a program monitoring telexes being sent inside and out into and out of the United States. It was run by Western Union and various other things. And they were giving copies of all these telexes and so on to NSA to analyze, and they'd been doing that since World War II.
And then there was why was that illegal?
Because it's collecting information on U.S. citizens without a warrant. That's a Fourth Amendment violation. So there's no probable cause. They had nothing probable cause. They were just taking it all.
Right.
And the same was true with a minaret, a program started under Nixon to monitor, you know, war protesters and people like Martin Luther King and John Lennon and so on. Well, I mean, there was a similar program, the COINTEL program was started in FBI, and CHAOS, I think, was the CIA counterpart. So they all had programs running to spy on U.S. citizens that had no probable cause.
Right.
So when that was breaking, of course, I thought that Nixon should be impeached for that because it's a violation of constitutional rights of people. So he eventually was impeached. And he was under indictment after he resigned and would have been going into court until his reappointed President Ford pardoned him. Well, when he did that, I mean, that said to me and to every other president following him that they have a get-out-of-jail-free card and it's the next president because every president has to support the other one because they may have to make tough decisions,
right,
without accountability. And so that took that accountability away. And so I blame all this on Jerry Ford, and so when he came up for election, I voted for our peanut farmer down there.
And I can't imagine that you were happy with the way all that.
No, I wasn't. But I also voted for McGovern instead of Nixon on the second go round.
Well, let's talk about successive presidents because you know your first brush with kind of whistleblowerdom took place under the George W. Bush administration and the George Bush
years. Our replacement for George III.
Right. And I mean, that did not go well. And Bush was doing warrantless wiretapping. He was trying to really push the limits of executive power and in many ways unaccountable power, certainly within the intelligence.
In secret.
Yes. Now, Barack Obama, is he as bad? Is he better or is he worse?
Well, I think he's doing a lot more. So, I mean, like President Bush, he wanted to capture the terrorists to torture them and get information.
Right.
Obama just wants to kill him.
Right.
So, and plus Obama is doing much more in terms of look at all the PRISM program, all that development over time. Most of that occurred in his watch, mm-hmm. and that's why they're now building Bluffdale, a large storage facility under him, mm-hmm. and building more storage over his 600,000 square foot facility over here at Fort Meade. Mm-hmm. So all this is happening under President Obama, and that's because they're collecting so much more data.
Do you think that Obama, you know, and now one of the things that is a kind of bitter irony is that Obama did not come in saying, hey, you know what, you know, I'm better than George Bush. I'm going to collect 10 times as much data. I'm going to spend 10 times as much money. He came in saying, I'm going to be the most transparent, run the most transparent administration ever. Does he understand what's going on, or is he, like a lot of congressmen, just kind of, you know, in a haze of, you know, what he's being told by people who won't let him into the champagne room, but they'll tell him, look, it's really important in here, but you can't come in and see it.
I can only guess, okay? I don't know for sure, but certainly I had a lot of hope when he came in because he was a constitutional lawyer. I thought he would see, okay, these are the violations of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Let's correct them.
Yeah. Or here, these are the limits of the Constitution. Here's how we exceed them.
Right. Well.
But do you think, I mean, is this a knowing practice on his part, or is he just being, faked out?
I think when he took office, right. One of the first things he does is he gets a security brief from all of the intelligence agencies, and they list out all the threats in the world and the things that they're doing to oppose the threats, and so he has an understanding. Mm-hmm. And I think what that did was probably scared him and maybe bamboozled him into thinking that they spout their narrative, and he buys into that. Mm-hmm. So once he buys into that, then he's locked, mm-hmm. right? And so he's stuck with them. I think that's the way it happened.
Do you, we've talked a little bit about, okay, you know, maybe we have a group of hackers or people who are answerable directly to Congress who have absolute access to whatever the intelligence agencies do.
All of Congress, not just committees.
Right.
I mean, that was the problem. See, when you just went with the intelligence committees, they controlled what the rest of Congress understood.
Right.
That's not good enough.
And I mean, I guess you're saying then that if we can't trust our Congress, our congressional representatives and our senators with what the government is doing, we are really asking for a hell of a lot of trouble.
They can't even trust themselves.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the agencies are lying to them. I mean, we've seen it already time and again. And they lie to one another, and they also lie to the administration. The administration lies back.
Are you optimistic? I mean, because, you know, in many ways this past year has been horrifying because of the revelations of the extent and the depth and the breadth of what the NSA and what other agencies within the government are doing and how they're misrepresenting that. On the other hand, you know, we know about it now, and people seem to be genuinely outraged. Gallup just released a poll that showed a record number of people in the 70% range think government is too powerful. What is the role of educating the public in terms of outrage to kind of stem these abuses?
Well, I think the role is we need to ensure that we get rid of all those people who've been there too long. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what people need to realize, that this comes about because people are entrenched in the government, and you need to get them out of there.
What do you mean by that, though? Is it like 5 years and out? Is it 20 years? Is it when they demonstrate
I would say no more than 8 years for anybody. 4 years for, I guess you'd have to go 12 years for a senator. But
you're talking about term limits and stuff like that.
Time limits, yeah.
Yeah, what about at the agencies themselves? I mean, what is too long? You were at NSA for over 30 years, right?
Right. Well, some of the agencies are, you know, it's difficult because you've got highly technical problems that you have to have people who understand it. It takes a long time to do that sometimes. But in the technology area, there's not a problem with that, I don't think. But in the management area is where the issues become. Where managers begin to control things in a way that aren't maybe technically smart. Mm-hmm. And if they start doing that, then they corrupt the entire process, which is what's happened over time here. So management has to be rotated in and out, and I think fresh people from the outside always help.
Do you think the NSA management and Congress maybe should do some trust-building exercises?
I don't think that would help them.
Retreat?
No. I don't think that would help them at all.
Well, I guess
we need to simply replace them. We need, in the next election, we need to come. If you're religious, we need to come to Jesus moment.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah. Well, as a final question, would you recommend a career in government for your grandchildren or for people who are just graduating college now?
I would, because I think that it's better to infiltrate and infect it from the inside with character and integrity. I mean, you can't get it from the outside because they simply lie to you. And they smile at you, walk away, and keep doing their thing. So, but if you infect it from the inside, you've got good people coming up the ranks. So I would, sure. I would just remember, anytime you do that and accept that kind of job, you just have to understand you have to protect your character and integrity through the whole process, because that's the first thing they'll try to do is corrupt that for you.
Well, William Binney, late of the NSA, thank you very much for talking with Reason
TV.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.